From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are following reaction in this country and around the world to last night's U.S. missile strike on a Syrian airfield. We'll get to the mixed feelings on Capitol Hill in a moment. But right now, we're joined by NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do we know at this point about whether the missiles did what they were aimed to do? For instance, were the runways at this airbase destroyed?
We don't have a lot of information about the conditions of the runway specifically. Defense officials were saying last night those were not among the targets at the Syrian airbase. What we do know from the Pentagon is that they believe they destroyed about 20 Syrian warplanes, as well as the hardened shelters that they used to try and protect them from air attack and fuel and air defense systems and the support equipment that you need to run an airbase and be able to launch aircraft. The Pentagon says it took as many precautions as it could not to hit people. However, so we believe there may have been fewer than about a dozen who might have been killed in this attack, although defense officials say they're still doing what they call a bomb damage assessment of how this went.
And does it appear that the Syrians were warned before the attack, potentially by their allies, the Russians, who were warned by the U.S.?
That's entirely possible. And in fact, that may have been the goal of the United States military in planning this attack, because the Defense Department was not trying to kill a lot of people if it could avoid that. And in fact, it has to work in a very kind of narrow alley of options between sending a message to the regime of Syrian President Bashar Assad and the Russians and the world, but also not taking such an aggressive and such an overt forceful action that it created a crisis of escalation with the Syrians. And so by telling the Russians who were on this airbase that something was in the works, they very likely told their Syrian hosts, and they very likely took whatever preparations they needed to get out of the way. But this was also at almost 4 o'clock in the morning local time, so it was probably pretty sleepy there anyway.
Meanwhile, what more do we know about the apparent chemical attack earlier this week in Syria that motivated this strike? The Associated Press is now reporting that U.S. military officials are investigating whether or not Russia was involved.
That's right. It was up in Idlib province above the Syrian airbase where this American missile attack took place. And what defense officials at the Pentagon said today is they aren't sure for their part whether Russia played a role. But it raised a lot of eyebrows after the attack was revealed and the now infamous stomach-churning video and TV pictures came out of it by saying maybe it wasn't the Syrians or maybe it was a false flag or Assad had no reason to launch such an attack. And using that kind of counter-message and propaganda, if you will, about what took place, definitely had a lot of people in the West very skeptical about what the Russians might have known and potentially what role they might have played, although we don't have solid answers about that yet.
Phil, just from a policy perspective, this was a major shift in Trump's thinking about Syria. Let's listen here to White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer speaking just last week.
With respect to Assad, I mean, there is a political reality that we have to accept in terms of where we are right now. We lost a lot of opportunity the last administration with respect to Assad. And I think that our restatement that UN Ambassador Haley gave yesterday reflects the reality that it is now at to the Syrian people. I mean, we had an opportunity and we need to focus on now defeating ISIS.
That seemed to signal a shift that the U.S. was no longer demanding that Assad leave power. But then here's President Trump last night.
Years of previous attempts at changing Assad's behavior have all failed and failed very dramatically. As a result, the refugee crisis continues to deepen and the region continues to destabilize, threatening the United States and its allies.
What is the U.S. stance right now on whether Assad should stay in power in Syria?
Well, the administration's position, as we heard from Spicer in the press conference from the clip you played, was that he can stay. But then we heard yesterday and the days before from the president and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson saying that they were reassessing that or that his future was unclear. And at this moment, as we're talking, I'm not sure anyone knows what the exact U.S. outlook on this is, except for the president, because he seems to be moving and changing position as the hours pass. We don't know, for example, whether this was just a one-off shot to send a message to Assad and send a message to the world, or whether this will augur some kind of bigger U.S. or international campaign to try to change the regime there. That would be a huge difference from the position Trump has taken before, and certainly his rhetoric as a presidential candidate when he was very critical of his predecessor Barack Obama and the general U.S. philosophy of the last 20 or so years about these engagements in the Middle East, if he starts to go down that road, that will be a big shift indeed. Right now, everyone is watching to see what happens in terms of military action or other big pronouncements from the Trump administration about this crisis in Syria.
That's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in NPR's congressional reporter, Scott Detrow, right now. Hi, Scott.
Hey there.
So what is the reaction in Washington? It seems complicated, not along party lines at all.
Yeah, I think we should start with one thing, that by and large, there is bipartisan support from leaders of both parties for for the strike itself last night as an isolated event. I think saying there's a lot of bipartisan support that the United States should be doing something in some way or somehow to deal with the Assad regime, especially when it comes to chemical weapons. Remember, earlier in the day yesterday, Hillary Clinton was giving a public talk, and she said, I think the U.S. needs to bomb airfields so that Assad cannot launch more chemical attacks. After that, it gets more complicated, and just one quick division is whether or not the Trump administration needs to come back to Congress for authorization for more things like this. There's a real split there. And that's generally along party lines, with some exceptions.
Let's talk a bit about that. Nancy Pelosi sent a letter to Speaker Paul Ryan saying, bring Congress back from recess because we need to have this debate on passing a new authorization for use of military force. These are the AUMFs. Congress hasn't passed one since just after 9/11. There are two. One was post 9/11 for Afghanistan, another for Iraq. And now there's this urge to get another one for action in Syria. But this would be very different. This would be an AUMF about authorizing a military attack against a country and a government as opposed to against terrorism.
Yeah. And anything regarding to dealing with the Assad government is much different than dealing with ISIS, where the focus has been over the last few months and, well, years, really. But when the Trump administration has come into power, they've said we want to focus on dealing with ISIS and had floated the idea of working with Assad, working with Russia to accomplish that goal, which this seems to remove the possibility of. You know, when it comes to whether or not Congress could and would pass an authorization like that, I think it's important to remember that President Obama, when he ultimately did not launch any attacks against Assad in Syria in 2012, he asked Congress to pass 2013, I should correct myself. He asked Congress to pass an authorization, and there were not enough votes to do so.
Right. Well, and just a quick question now. So a lot of people, liberal to the right, are saying, yes, those pictures of the children in particular poisoned, apparently by gas attacks, we need to do something. But does that put them in a tough spot? Because, you know, everybody wants to respond, but these are strikes against a country. I mean, even if they have to gather to see if there's an authorization for further military action, if they are all agreeing that the strikes by President Trump were called for, aren't they all walking down that path?
Well, I think that one dynamic that you're hearing from Democrats in particular, Chris Murphy, senator from Connecticut, pointing out, and others have as well, is that when it comes to the urge to help the people who were attacked by these chemical weapons, and it seems from what we're hearing that there was a real personal motivation for President Trump, seeing the pictures, responding to them, wanting to help these babies, as President Trump said it last night, that there's a real kind of contradiction between an urge to be helpful to the Syrian people in that way and a push to ban refugees from Syria from entering the United States as the initial executive order on immigration tried to do. Those two don't really address each other. And I think that's a question that a lot of people will be asking the Trump White House going forward. We haven't heard a clear explanation on why you want to help them in one way but not another.
Yeah, a lot of questions are raised. But let's get to the other big news of the day.
On this vote, the ayes are 54, the nays are 45. The nomination of Neil M. Gorsuch of Colorado to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States is confirmed.
It's predictable. We knew it would happen, but also extremely significant. The seat that Gorsuch will occupy has been vacant for more than a year since Antonin Scalia died, and Republicans refused to take up President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. Can this wound in the Senate heal?
I think that's hard to say. I think, you know, we talked all week about kind of the bipartisan sadness and frustration that this rule had to be reworked. But, you know, it's funny that the Gorsuch nomination has been such a big story. And then on the day it finally happens and he's confirmed to the Supreme Court, it's like, you know, the second level story of the day. But this was a big moment. And I think it's fair to say that this is the biggest accomplishment yet of the Trump administration. They've run into so many roadblocks in Congress, including that health care bill kind of hitting the wall. But this is something the Senate has now approved it. Trump has named someone to the Supreme Court. That's something every president wants to do. Not everyone gets a chance to do. And Gorsuch, I think, even though he's replacing another conservative, a lot of people say he can have a really big impact on the court and might kind of pull it to the right.
Scott Detrow, NPR congressional reporter. We also have to wait to see what the strikes do to impact maybe the rest of the president's agenda. Tax reform. You mentioned health care, trade. So we'll keep an eye on that as well. Scott, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Will climate change come up in the talks between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping? Last week, Trump revoked many of President Obama's executive orders on climate change and moved to dismantle the Clean Power Plan, which was supposed to curb greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. Meanwhile, China has emerged as a world leader in renewable energy, facing political unrest from the Chinese people over its ongoing pollution crisis. With the U.S. rolling back many of its policies, some say China will also pole vault to world leader on climate change. Imagine that. Kelly Sims Gallagher was a senior China advisor and the special envoy for climate change under President Obama. She's now a professor of energy and environmental policy at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Kelly, professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And boy, how the tables have turned. Your thoughts on how it was once, you know, you and others in the Obama administration really trying to cajole China into joining the thinking on cutting emissions. Now it's China, some would say, shaming the U.S.
Well, yes, indeed. What a difference a few months makes. It is true that the Chinese are seemingly determined to stay the course no matter what happens with the Trump administration. And that's very good news because the Chinese are the largest emitter of greenhouse gases globally by a lot. So it's very important that they continue to reduce their emissions domestically.
Well, and the leaders have been civil, but the Global Times, which is a state-run nationalist newspaper, so one would think this is what the Chinese leaders would say if they could, the Global Times chastised the Trump administration for, quote, brazenly shirking its responsibility on climate change, the Trump administration becoming the first government of a major power to take opposite actions on the Paris Agreement. Is China now the leader in addressing emissions and climate change?
Well, certainly in terms of its commitments to reduce emissions over the coming decade, I think it's fair to say that China's definitely the leader of developing countries. It was the first to set a peaking goal. In other words, that emissions would reach a peak and then turn around and start to be reduced. That's no small feat, given that China is an enormous country and relies very heavily on coal. In terms of absolute emissions reductions, other countries are ahead of China, but most of those countries are industrialized countries.
Well, I'm talking more about, you know, leadership and the talk, perhaps. I mean, when you talk about China's emissions dropping, coal consumption, we reported on this, when it declined, it surprised a lot of analysts because, as you say, so many people in China are still using coal. But how else is it showing signs that it absolutely is putting coal behind it?
Well, a few years ago, China instituted the first ever domestic coal consumption cap. So it actually, the government issued a total cap on the amount of coal that consumers and industry could use. And as a result, coal consumption has declined the last 2 years, and the carbon dioxide emissions also declined slightly during the last 2 years.
Well, in part, China might be propelled by the fact that its people are getting sick. You know, they can't breathe in some cities. So again, it has more to address. But looking forward, we understand China is also seeing battling climate change as good for its economy. How so?
Well, central to the Chinese economic reform agenda is the desire to reform the economy away from heavy industry, polluting industry, towards services and lighter industry. And as a natural consequence of that, if they're successful in the reform, their economy would move to cleaner industries and thereby achieve significant reductions in air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, there's a report from the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis that said China was the world leader in domestic investment in renewable energy, $103 billion invested in 2015, and then globally they've invested $32 billion in overseas deals involving renewable energy. And, you know, they see those as good investments.
Yeah, the Chinese view the renewable energy industry as the industry of the future, and they've invested heavily in these industries. They also have very stable policies underpinning those investments to provide predictability to the market. And so as a result, they've set a goal of achieving 20% of their energy consumption from renewable energy by 2030.
Yeah. Well, you said an important thing. They're a communist country, you know, led by a regime. So when they decide to go in a certain direction, there's no debate. You know, everyone is going in that direction. We in the U.S. have debate. Do you think that China in these talks, it's early days, but that China, I can't believe I'm saying the sentence, but that China might convince the U.S. leaders and the current administration to change their thinking on emissions and climate change?
It's very hard to predict how President Trump will respond to that kind of message. But indeed, I think the Chinese believe it is in the best interests of both countries to address climate change. We share the lion's share of the responsibility for causing climate change together. You know, the fact that climate change became a bright spot in the U.S.-China bilateral relationship during the end of the Obama administration was very important to the relationship between the two countries. It demonstrated that we had a mature relationship. We could agree on some things and work together, shouldering global responsibility, and disagree on other things. And it was a sign of the maturity of the relationship that we could do both at the same time.
Yeah, you helped strike that bilateral deal with China to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so the question is, how might China now impact the Trump administration? But we've also been hearing reporting that if the U.S. pulls out of a leadership role, pulls out of the Paris Agreement, pulls out of the thinking of cutting emissions by certain dates and those kinds of commitments, that China might pull back as well. Do you agree?
China was always most comfortable sharing that leadership role. You may remember Xi Jinping put forth a theory of great power relations, and that theory essentially indicated that together China would join other countries to shoulder responsibility for global issues such as climate change. And I think China feels very uncomfortable being the sole leader of any kind of global effort.
So this could maybe impact sort of the global fight on emissions and set China back, oddly, perhaps.
It's possible. I think the fact that the Paris Agreement entered into force and is a standing global treaty now gives China plenty of international cover for its domestic actions. And indeed, many other countries have already indicated that they intend to adhere to the Paris Agreement. And so there's safety in numbers. So I think most countries will continue to adhere to the agreement.
That's Kelly Sims Gallagher, professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts, senior China advisor and the special envoy for climate change under former President Obama. She worked directly with the Chinese. Professor Gallagher, Kelly, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, it was not the jobs report that economists were expecting today. The latest numbers from the Labor Department show the U.S. economy added just 98,000 jobs in March. Economists were predicting almost twice as many after two straight months of strong job growth to start the year. The good news, the unemployment rate dropped to 4.5%. That's the lowest it's been in nearly a decade. Joining us now is Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And this report took some people by surprise. Economists had expected 180,000 new jobs in March. What happened?
Well, a lot of economists and really the stock and bond markets, too, are looking past this number as sort of a fluke. And there's one simple reason. If you remember, there was that nasty snowstorm in the Northeast that just so happened to occur right in the middle of the week when the survey was done. So let's say you're a builder planning to break ground on a new project and hire a bunch of construction workers. Obviously, you see the weather forecast, especially one that was hyped as much as this storm was, and you postpone those plans. So economists are sort of looking at as that as basically the explanation for the weakness. You know, the Labor Department does adjust for normal seasonal issues, but it doesn't adjust the numbers for a big outlier event like this.
Well, and whenever the numbers are gloomy, you always blame the weather.
Blame the weather, yeah.
Somehow there's no bad weather in for months and months and months. But anyway, what about the fact that the unemployment rate kept going down? Why did that happen?
That's done with a different survey. That's done with a survey of households, whereas the number of jobs, the breakdown of the number of jobs in each industry is done through a survey of businesses. And it did. It went down to the lowest really since 2007. And it looks good, especially because it was not accompanied by a drop in the labor force participation rate. In other words, the unemployment rate did not go down because more people are dropping out of the workforce. So it's a healthy number.
So the Trump administration has been touting jobs reports this year from January and February as proof that his administration is good for the economy. What does this March report do for that argument?
I mean, it certainly gives him a data point to brag about. 4.5%, again, the lowest since 2007. How much credit he actually deserves for it is debatable. Obviously, that figure has been going down pretty steadily for almost 8 years. But it is there for him to brag about if you would like to.
And just briefly, what does this mean for Fed rates? Will they still go up this year a couple times?
Yeah, the market's not really pricing in much of a difference because of this report. It still looks like about a 66% probability of a rate increase in June and likely one more before the year is out.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, with the news on today's jobs report from the Labor Department. Mike, thanks.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
There's been a lot of reaction today to the U.S. missile attack on a Syrian Air Force base. There's been praise. House Speaker Paul Ryan tweeted that the attack was appropriate and just, but Congresswoman Barbara Lee tweeted the strike was an act of war that needed congressional authorization. Much of the response is unfolding on social media, so let's bring in Femi Oke. She hosts The Stream on Al Jazeera English and joins us from Washington. Femi, what other kind of reaction are you seeing online?
It's an ongoing conversation right now, maybe a battle between ideologies as well, internationally and domestically too. Sean Spicer, the press secretary for the Trump administration, shared a photograph just an hour or so ago. It's a White House photograph. In parentheses, he says, edited for security, at POTUS receives briefing on Syria military strike from national security team. It looks quite reminiscent of a photograph of the Obama administration when they had just ordered Osama bin Laden be taken down. So people are making that comparison between these two photographs. The photograph that Sean Spicer is showing is from Donald Trump's southern base, he likes to call it, in Florida. The other conversations that are going on right now, pushback from Russia on Facebook. Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev says that right now, this missile strike has completely ruined relations between the U.S. and Russia. In his Facebook message, he says, the Trump administration proved that it will fiercely fight the legitimate Syrian government. Meanwhile, Syrian state TV is calling the missile attack an act of aggression. MSNBC live coverage is also making news, not because of the coverage, but because of something that Brian Williams said last night. He quoted Leonard Cohen. Let me quote him, quoting Leonard Cohen.
Right.
He says, I'm tempted to quote the great Leonard Cohen. I am guided by the beauty of our weapons. They are beautiful pictures of fearsome armaments. Twitter was not happy with the way he was describing this missile attack. And let me give you an example here. Yeah. Jay the Prophet says, "The war hawks in the press are out. Watch them praise Trump at every stage."
Wow. So it is unfolding. It's a national conversation, international conversation. We want to hear more from you, but also just make sure we check in on some other news today from Twitter.
Sure.
Because it's withdrawing the lawsuit it filed earlier this week against the Department of Homeland Security. Now, Twitter had sued the department because it was trying to unmask, that word again, the identity of a Twitter user at @alt_USCIS. That is an Alternative U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. And a number of accounts popped up after President Trump took office and put limits on social media posts from some government agencies. And so here's this one that appears to be a government agency, very critical of Trump. The Homeland Department wanted to get the name. Twitter was going to sue, has withdrawn. Just very briefly, what's happened?
Sure. Twitter was asked for the name, the phone number, the mailing address, the IP address, the login, and also the identity behind this rogue Twitter account. They filed a suit to say, no, you can't do this. This is defending the First Amendment, free speech. The counsel for Twitter met the counsel for the Department of Homeland Security, and now they have dropped their case. They no longer are asking for this information. Twitter have withdrawn their case. So everybody is standing down, and anybody who has a rogue account, government account right now, you can breathe easily. Tweet on.
At least for today. Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Thanks as always.
You're welcome, Robin.
Before the news of the U.S. missile attack in Syria last night, there was news this week of a North Korean ballistic missile launch just before the first summit meeting between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. How to halt North Korea's nuclear program is one of the main topics on the summit's agenda. Trump wants China to work harder to rein in North Korea. Joining us now is Sig Hecker, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford and emeritus director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. Sig Hecker, welcome to Here and Now.
It's my pleasure.
And what do you make of Secretary of State Tillerson's response to North Korea's latest missile launch, that the United States has spoken enough about North Korea and has no further comment?
Well, it's hard to know what to do with that particular comment. At this point, my view has always been, actually, that what we need to do now is talk to North Korea.
One-on-one, just the United States and North Korea?
As it turns out, that would be the most productive. And actually, the reason for talking, a lot of people misunderstand, why talk again? You know, haven't we negotiated off and on over the years? The reason for talking now is because the Trump administration, and of course that includes Secretary Tillerson, they face an entirely different threat than the previous three presidential administrations have faced. The threat today is the North Koreans have a nuclear arsenal. And the challenge today is, how do we make sure that there is no nuclear catastrophe on the Korean Peninsula? In other words, that those weapons are not used. And to do that, it takes the United States to talk directly to North Korea.
Well, let's go back to the point where North Korea managed to get a nuclear program. And I think in the modern history of North Korea, we kind of have to go back to the 1994 agreement between President Clinton and North Korea. Tell us what that did exactly, first of all.
So actually what happened is the North Koreans had been building the capacity to be able to build the bomb for several decades before the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration's challenge was, how do we stop the North Korean from getting the bomb? And he did this through what was called the Agreed Framework in 1994. And by the time he left office, it's my general sense, the North Koreans did not have a bomb. And so he more or less succeeded. However, in the next administration, the George W. Bush administration, there are a number of officials who simply did not like the agreed framework. Eventually, they wound up walking away from that, having accused the North Koreans of cheating. When they walked away, they weren't prepared for the consequences, in that North Korea then built the bomb. So the best as we know, North Korea built the bomb sometime 2003, 2004.
And was there any way the United States could have stopped that from happening?
Well, the general sense, at least particularly of the Clinton administration, was that they were very close at the end of the Clinton administration of coming to resolution. In other words, part of the deal was that the U.S., in conjunction with South Korea and Japan, would actually build the North Koreans electricity-producing modern reactors. In return, the North Koreans would drop their nuclear weapons ambitions. The U.S. also had promised to sort of develop a normal relations, normalization of relations with North Korea. So that's probably the best chance that we had. In the Bush administration, I think there was just too much suspicion of North Korea cheating, and so I don't think we had much chance. In the Obama administration, it was very interesting. The challenge there was they had the bomb, but how do you stop North Korea from getting a real nuclear arsenal? The Obama administration tried. However, in the end, they lost faith pretty quickly. And so that's what I mean by today. The challenge is very different. They have a nuclear arsenal, and there's the potential for a nuclear catastrophe. And so that's why it takes a different approach today.
But you also hear the critics of that approach who would say, we're dealing here with a guy who appears to be addicted to drugs, among other things. He's not a rational actor. How can you work with Kim Jong-un?
Well, I disagree with the fact that, let's say, he is irrational. If you look at what he's done in 5 years, I mean, he's built a formidable nuclear arsenal. I think he's unpredictable. And for the most part, the danger is we simply know so little about him. And that is actually precisely the reason that I believe we need to go talk. And that is to make sure that he doesn't believe the young man that he is, that somehow those nuclear weapons can be used in some limited fashion, that there may be no particular danger of escalating a conventional confrontation into a nuclear confrontation, that it really understands how dangerous nuclear weapons are to those within country. In other words, either from a nuclear weapons accident or the issue of the security of those nuclear weapons.
What do you think the North Korean nuclear capability is at this point? Do you have a sense of how big their arsenal is now?
It's very difficult to assess the size of that arsenal. The best that we can actually do is to try to estimate how much of the bomb fuel that North Korea could have made. In other words, the plutonium and the highly enriched uranium. Based on those estimates, I think it's possible that North Korea today has sufficient bomb fuel for 20 to 25 nuclear weapons. The most important aspect of assessing their nuclear capabilities are the fact that they've done 5 nuclear tests. And the last few nuclear tests have been on the destructive power on the order of a Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So in other words, they know how to make a bomb big enough to destroy an entire city. And with the enormous rocket and missile campaign they had in 2016, I now generally believe, although again, all of this is very uncertain, that they most likely can put a nuclear warhead on missiles that can reach all of South Korea, all of Japan, and perhaps some U.S. assets in the Pacific. I do not believe they have the capability to reach the United States as yet.
Do you think that they would ever give up the nuclear program? Would you ever go from having the leverage that a nuclear power has to not having that leverage? Is there a deal the U.S. could make to get them to give it up?
So at this particular time, I think there's no way that North Korea would give up its nuclear weapons. What the Chinese tend to say is, look, it's you Americans that have caused the North Koreans to get nuclear weapons. You caused them their security anxiety. And unless and until that anxiety is resolved, North Korea is not going to give up its nuclear weapons. That is a long-term project. Talking now is to avoid the use of weapons and to lay the groundwork that eventually one might be able to get to a point where one can convince the North Koreans they're actually better off without nuclear weapons than with them.
It seems like every time the issue of North Korea comes up, one of the first things that U.S. leaders will say is, well, you've just got to put more pressure on China. China will fix the problem if they really apply pressure. What do you think of that, Sig Hecker?
So my view is that the last couple of administrations indeed have believed two things. One is sanction and more pressure from China. That hasn't worked, and in my opinion, it will not work.
I want to ask you one more thing, because you, unlike probably everyone who's listening to this program right now, or almost all of them, have been to North Korea. What sticks with you from your visits to that country?
So I've been there seven times, four times in the nuclear facilities. And I would say the first and most important thing is the capabilities of the nuclear technical people and the complex. And then the other aspect, sort of the people. We tend to demonize the leadership of other countries, and some countries certainly deserve it, but we shouldn't demonize the people.
That's Sig Hecker, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University and emeritus director of Los Alamos National Laboratory. And as we've heard there, somebody who's been to North Korea many, many times. Sig Hecker, thank you for joining us.
It was my pleasure, Jeremy.
According to reports, anonymous military officials are saying the U.S. is looking into whether Russia participated in that apparent chemical attack in Syria this week. Whether or not they did, the Russians were responsible for removing Syria's chemical weapons under the Obama-era deal. And there's been a lot of response to President Trump's retaliatory strikes on a Syrian airfield last night. So how are his voters and fierce supporters reacting? Let's check in with one. Jackie Trudell of Appleton, Wisconsin, a 63-year-old semi-retired marketing professional, former president of the Wisconsin Federation of Republican Women. She joins us from the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio in Green Bay. Jackie, hi.
Hi.
And, you know, we talked to you before this call, of course, and asked if there was a line President Trump could cross that would lose your support. You told us if he did anything illegal or against the Constitution. Now, both the Democrat, Senator Tim Kaine, and the Republican Rand Paul, the senators, have joined the chorus of voices saying that waging military action without a vote in Congress is unlawful, according to Kaine, and unconstitutional, according to both.
I'm aware of that, and yes, we do have that. My understanding is that he should have had gone to Congress for approval. I don't know if there is any way around that. I think that we have to wait and see.
There may be something that he could use to go around that requirement. But how do you feel about the strikes, given that, you know, Donald Trump campaigned against intervening in foreign conflicts? He said, I'm not president of the world.
I think one of the things I've learned in watching him, and I think that I've seen something the other day when it came out with the pictures of those children, and he actually mentioned that he was rethinking this. And one of the issues that I've always had with some of our political figures is they, you know, dig their heels in and situations change. I think he tried to send a message, letting them know that we are not going to condone that kind of action. And it'll be interesting to see what the reaction is of Putin.
Well, I was just going to say, are you worried about that? The slippery slope? I mean,
it could be. Yeah. I mean, I think we'd be foolish not to worry about it.
Well, you're also worried about the if you break it, you own it. Once you enter a conflict, you are responsible for a portion of it. And, you know, that includes refugees fleeing this conflict. And as you well know, you know, President Trump had his ban on Muslim travelers, reducing the refugees that could come to this country. You saw those pictures of those children. Wouldn't you want to help those families come here as refugees?
Yes, but I also believe that we have to do proper vetting. So I think what they're trying to do, and this is a temporary ban, it's not permanent. It's just to give our immigration the opportunities to make sure that they have the proper vetting procedures in place.
Staying with the bans and with the president's agenda, the 100th day of Donald Trump in office is coming up on April 29th. The second travel ban, even with the revision, was blocked by federal judges. He could not overturn Obamacare day one, as promised, or build a wall. That hasn't happened yet. Tax reform, nothing yet. What is your sense of the presidency so far?
You know, I look at the presidency as a very complex job that sometimes I wonder why anybody would want that job. I think it's ironic with the complexity of the presidency of the United States that we monitor his progress on a daily basis, and we're constantly reviewing him.
I mean, that's
Obamacare.
What yeah, that's
you're right. It happens. It is. But Obamacare is very complex. Was I disappointed? Absolutely. But I think that we have to take a look at making sure we do it right. What I look at, and going back and how is he doing, I'm surprised at how much he has done, even though some of these major issues haven't been resolved yet.
What would you point to?
Well, I look at what he's doing in reference to making jobs. You know, some of the things that he has done.
Well, I have to say the new jobs report today was terrible.
Well, and you're going to see some fluctuation.
What about the White House itself? Have you been at all shaken by Steve Bannon, someone with absolutely no security experience being put on the National Security Council and then removed? The allegations of ties between Trump campaign supporters and Trump associates and Russia? Representative Nunes having to step down from an investigation because he received material from White House aides. Has any of this shaken your faith?
You know, there's always a concern, but I also believe in this, that as a citizen here, I think that when you're going through, this is a paramount process for an individual come in. You also have someone that doesn't have a political background. I think it's okay to watch, and if somebody makes a mistake, a good leader will go and correct that. We've seen some mistakes, but it's not like we haven't seen mistakes with other leaders. And I think that as we see the mistakes, if these are corrected and we move on from them, that's good, as long as it's not malicious intent or fraud, because that would concern me.
That's Jackie Trudell of Appleton, Wisconsin, a Donald Trump supporter, former president of the Wisconsin Federation of Republican Women, weighing in today. Jackie, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.